Welcome. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Well, good afternoon. As the parties are aware, we are painfully connected by technology this morning, but we are nonetheless connected. And for the record, for our audio recording of the proceedings, I will just state that we are not present in the same location because of the coronavirus state of emergency, and for the good of the public, the party, and the attorneys, we are appearing and holding our argument only by video conferencing, the tool WebEx, with none of us present in the same location. And we are all quite aware that the technology may be glitchy. So please bear that in mind so that if you're having difficulty either hearing or seeing any of the participants, please flag us so we know and we can make whatever pause is necessary to accommodate so that everyone can see and hear along with the proceedings. The timing restrictions are the same as if you were in person, so each side will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for the appellant's counsel if you choose to use it for rebuttal. Please do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument because the recording will only be of an audio, not video. Counsel for appellant, please proceed.
Good morning. This is Nahida Bulhassan on behalf of the appellant, Nihat Hamad. May please the court, the appellant submit to the court the following oral argument. There are three issues that were not properly resolved by the parties' divorce decree. This was a very conflict case. We tried to solve the issues through financial early neutral evaluation. Since there are no children involved, we did not reach an agreement. We proceeded to trial. The first issue, I argue on behalf of the appellant that the district court abused its discretion by not allowing us to submit documents for showing that the respondent was engaged in dissipating of marital assets prior to the divorce. The appellant left the marital home to a shelter on September 27, 2017. The same day, actually within minutes, we have exhibit in court submitted by the respondent showing that he went through bank accounts where him and the appellant shared joint accounts, and he cashed out all the funds, transferred that fund to his own personal account where the appellant did not have access to. He's not denying that fact. Prior to that, there was another large portion of money taken from the account in the same month the appellant left the marital home, almost $10,000 cash. The court, when we offered exhibits to show the dissipation of marital assets, the court excluded this evidence, claiming that the only evidence that will be accepted is what will show the balances on the accounts on the valuation date that was set as January 9th, 2018. But the issue for dissipating of marital assets does not have anything with the valuation date. We tried to explain this to the court. The court excluded all the bank statements. So we believe that the district court abused its discretion by not permitting us to prove that the respondent went through bank accounts right before he served the petition for dissolution, right after he filed for divorce, by leaving only 14 cents in three bank accounts with Think Bank after wiping out the accounts and moving the money to his own personal account with Wells Fargo. Also, we believe
the district court, as I understand it, found that your client failed to actually establish that there was, as a matter of fact, failed to prove that there was dissipation of assets?
Well, if we go through the transcript of the first day of the hearing, the district court excluded the evidence I offered to show that these bank statements would show there was dissipation of marital assets. The district court reasoned, she wouldn't, the judge reasoned that her honor would not accept any bank statements other than that bank statements around the valuation date. And in fact, the district court very much relied on 1 month of bank statement from for each account. And that would not permit my client to show what happened prior to the valuation date. So we have a claim that marital assets were dissipated in contemplation of a divorce. Given the fact there is an exhibit respondent himself submitted in court just to prove that there are three bank accounts with Think Bank showing that he left 14 cents in each one of them, showing that on September 27, 2017, minutes after my client left to a shelter, he cashed out all of this account, these balances, and removed her name from the bank accounts. Yet, the district court awarded my client these bank accounts, where we have an exhibit showing the responder removed her name the same day she left to a shelter and cashed out the money. So the district court ignored that not only the judge excluded our evidence, but ignored that we have evidence submitted by the respondent himself showing what he did on the day my client left the marital home, which is contemplation for a divorce. He engaged in dissipating of marital asset. That's one issue. So the district court not only abused its discretion by not accepting into evidence this bank statement showing what the respondent had done, but also ignored the evidence provided by the respondent himself. The other issue was that we needed to submit the bank statement to show from the time the appellant left the marital home, filed for an order for protection, went through a new trial requested by the respondent, until we get to the trial date, which was the first day was on November 15th, 2018. The respondent used these marital funds to pay for his own attorney's fees. And Baker v. Baker clearly states that the court should account for attorney's fees paid by marital assets. So here, my client did not have a chance to use the marital asset to pay her own attorney's fees, even though she requested that. And the district court denied her request. She asked for temporary attorney's fees. That didn't happen. And then when the final decree came down, the court, in dividing the marital assets, primarily bank accounts, balances held in bank accounts, permitted the respondent to use the marital fund to pay for his own attorney's fees, but when dividing the asset, did not count for that. So very much my client ended up paying the respondent attorney's fees as well, which is not the law, which not Baker v. Baker stands for. Also, when we come to dividing the asset itself, even if we say the court went with what was there on the valuation day, the court very much gave the respondent all the money held in the bank accounts on his name and awarded my client an account that she opened after she left the marital home.
But the court also placed the burden of the debts on the respondent. I don't think your brief addresses the balance between the assets and the debts.
Most of the debt, Your Honor, was incurred by the respondent after the valuation date. So it should be his own responsibility. And even during the trial, during cross-examination, counsel for the respondent agreed and stipulated that many of the exhibits showing that that was dead either premarital or dead that the respondent obtained after the valuation date. The respondent
how much of the debt falls in between before the valuation date and after the marriage began?
I believe the respondent has about over $60,000 premarital debt.
My question is not premarital debt. I'm asking you about marital debt. How much of the debt was incurred during the marriage before the valuation?
I believe it wasn't that significant because they were paid monthly, like the using of the credit cards for food and purchases of clothes and stuff. And then when the bills come, they get paid. So the debt itself in between was not a lot. And here we also argued
harsh. Well, when you say it was not a lot, quantify it for us.
I don't want to mistake, but I don't think it's more than a few thousand. Because I don't have that exhibit in front of me, Your Honor, but it's submitted to court to show how much the debt before, during, and after. And we also argued hardship in allocating the debt because my client did not work, was virtually present, was not allowed to leave the home alone, did not learn English, did not visit anybody, nobody visited her during the time she lived with the respondent. She had no access to bank accounts. All the purchases were made by the respondent. And she had no means to pay this debt. So he had control over the assets and the debt. And he made all the purchases with regard to food, whatever he purchased for the household.
Ms. Abu Hassan, I'd like to ask a question, kind of following up on Judge Ross's question about the debt. I'm looking at the district court's order, and in the findings of fact section under property and debt division, the district court first sets forth the non-joint accounts regarding petitioner's non-joint child, and then sets out the three accounts that he has jointly with his mother, a third party. And then it says the parties have the following marital accounts in paragraph 57. And then in paragraph 59, the parties have the following debts. And then it lists debts, all of which are in petitioner's name. My question for you is, do you believe that the district court classified all of the debts in paragraph 59 as marital debt?
Yes. That's a mistake. And I also add, these amounts and numbers, the list, the district court classified as marital, non-marital, the exhibit don't reflect this classification. The district court used the amount at the time of trial, even though the district court seemed to contradict itself by saying, I'm going by the valuation date, but the amount that are listed on this are the amount and the date of the trial, which is not how marital asset and debt allocation has to be determined.
And maybe I missed it. Maybe I missed it, but I'm wondering where in the brief you're arguing that the district court misclassified the debt as marital debt when it really should have been non-marital debt. I see in the brief where you make the argument about assets, but I don't see one about debt.
The transcript, I refer to the transcript in multiple places where the petition, the respondent himself conceded that the student loans is premarital, the debt he had from Kuwait is premarital.
Right, but I'm asking a specific question about where in your brief can I find the argument about the district court's error assigning or classifying what's listed in paragraph 59 as marital?
I think I answered that in my reply brief, but
Well, I think in your moving brief is where we have to find an argument where you are challenging as clearly erroneous the district court's fact findings. So are you acknowledging that you did not challenge in your brief the district court's fact finding ascribing the debt, all of the debt, as marital property?
I think I challenged that in my motion for amended finding.
No, I'm talking about your brief to this court. In order for us to ascribe error, we first have to find that you've made an argument that error exists.
I refer to it, for example, when I addressed the jewelry, the court awarded the jewelry, for example.
We're talking about the debt, not the jewelry. We're talking about the debt.
I don't want to say I did not. As I said, I misunderstood the assignment of this oral argument today, but if it is not in my brief, then it's not in my brief.
All right. Well, you will have, although your time is expiring now, during respondent's argument, maybe you can take a moment and quickly glance over your brief, and you can then identify for us during your rebuttal argument where, if at all, you make the argument challenging the findings of the district court with regard to characterizing the debt as marital debt.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent. You are muted. You're still muted.
Technology is wonderful. Can you hear me now?
Now we can definitely hear you.
I would like to say that what I stated before was very eloquent and you would have been impressed by it, but I'll start over. May it please the court, Maury Beaulieu for the respondent Dia Jubara. I think I will address, we didn't get to the spousal maintenance issues or the legal issue or the legal fees issue with Ms. Abelhausen, so I'll start with the property as well. And the first thing I'd like to point out
Before you get there, can I have you jump in where she began, which is she does make the argument in her brief that as to dissipation of funds, can you point us in your brief to where you directly respond to that argument?
I don't respond to the dissipation argument because there was no evidence in the record of dissipation. And Ms. Abelhausen makes the argument that she was precluded from presenting it, which is not true. If you look to the transcript on November 15th, page 29, lines 1 through 16, the court allowed her to present her evidence as impeachment evidence. They wouldn't allow her to present it as her case in chief because the parties had agreed to previously in numerous hearings a valuation date of the assets. And that had been repeated in numerous court proceedings prior to the trial. Ms. Abelhausen brought no motion to expand the record. She brought no offer of proof, but she could have presented it as impeachment, and she didn't do so.
Let me interrupt, Mr. Is it Beaulieu?
Perfect, Beaulieu, that's correct.
Beaulieu, okay. Ms. Abu Hassan has, in her brief, addressed the exclusion of this evidence. The district court did exclude it substantively, along with some other exhibits. And as I look at the transcript, there were a lot of objections that you raised to the exhibits, but it looks to me as if the district court relied on the valuation date to rule on the relevancy of the dissipation evidence, these bank account statements. So my question is, if we're looking at an appeal of an evidentiary ruling for relevancy, excluding these exhibits, why is it irrelevant when you're talking about dissipation of assets to look prior to the valuation date?
And I don't think it was irrelevant. I don't think, Ms. Abelhausen presented the evidence the way she should. If you look at the transcript, pages 1 through all the way up to 29, with the objections you reviewed, there were numerous irregularities in Mrs. Abelhausen, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering her name.
I think it's Abulhassan.
Abulhassan.
And Mr. Beaulieu, my question is, What do you think the district court ruled? Because it looks to me, and I just reviewed that this morning, it looks to me as the district court excluded on the basis of relevancy. And I'm wondering what you think, if you, as you're in the position to defend that ruling on relevancy, if you can explain why it would be irrelevant on a dissipation claim that something happened prior to the valuation date. Isn't that what dissipation's focused on? What happens prior to the valuation?
That's a great question. And I think all you need to do is look to page 29 of the transcript where the court allows her to present her evidence. She can present her evidence as impeachment evidence, because the only person, as she stated in her initial argument, in charge of the finances was the respondent, my client. Her client couldn't have presented anything with regard to that because she had no firsthand knowledge. So she was allowed to present her evidence, and it's specifically allowed on page 29, and she didn't do it. She presented none of it. She tried to get none of it in as impeachment, even though she was allowed to do so. So it was exclusionary. Now, I would also point out that what she was trying to get in was evidence that my client had used his mother's account, where we had shown it was a premarital account and had balanced his premarital, that he continued to try and pay back, but was unable to do so and had to keep drawing the money out. To that end, in finding of fact 39, the court finds essentially there is, quote, no marital property, which is true. The only assets the parties had were in their joint bank accounts, which had a relatively minimal value, whereas they had significant debt, and as the court points out in the spousal maintenance section, lived well beyond their means. I would also point out that as part of the analysis in any property division case, the court must look at, under 518.58, all relevant factors, including the length of the marriage, the age of the parties, and the contribution to the asset. The court was very clearly aware that the parties lived together for 1 year and 10 days. Their marriage was of 3 years, but they lived together for 1 year and 10 days. During that period of time, the appellant never worked. She didn't contribute in any way to any of the assets. The account that Ms. Abulhassan is raising is his mother's account, where he is a power of attorney for his mother. And she allowed him to use that account to meet his monthly expenses because they were living beyond their means. He testified that he was expected to pay that back to his mother. And
well, let me stop you there, because I think if you're using your parents' money to pay for marital expenses and you've agreed to pay her back, your mother back, wouldn't there be, now this isn't something that Ms. Abulhassan has brought up, but wouldn't it have been more proper for the district court to address this as a marital liability, what he now owes to his mother, as opposed to saying that those power of attorney, those accounts, they're non-marital in part because they are a third party account, but really what we're talking about is a failing on the district court to classify a marital debt as opposed to an error that the district court made in classifying these bank accounts as non-marital. Would you agree with it?
Well, we did argue, in fact, and that's a great question. We did argue, in fact, that it was a marital debt. But I think what the court did is it just basically said, again, in your finding of fact 39, there is no marital property. And then it included those accounts as non-marital. But that eliminates Ms. Abulhassan's argument of the dissipation of assets from those accounts, because they aren't even his. And what is in there was belonging to his mother. So I think that's where the court was intending the findings to land. That appears to be it from my view.
I'd like to change the focus, counsel, and ask you to talk about the issue of spousal maintenance, because you know, I am concerned about the district court's findings and frankly, lack thereof. I mean, it appears that the district court decided that appellant was capable of working full time and thus is finding basically that she is voluntarily underemployed. Yet the court makes no findings about what she is capable of earning and no findings about to what extent income is going to be imputed And so we are left with a record that seems to indicate she makes $8,000 a year, and district court determinations that she is able to adequately self-support. I'm having trouble understanding how we can find the evidence supports that determination, given the lack of findings about appellant's employment situation.
Where you're coming from on that, and if you look at the record as a whole with the other factors related to spousal support, including the length of the marriage and...
But I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's the second subdivision, and we have a district court order on the first subdivision that doesn't get to that yet. Sure. And I understand there's overlap, right? So, you know, right. Factor three of the second subdivision is the standard of living, the marital standard of living, which you're supposed to consider in the first subdivision. So there's definitely overlap. But before you start making arguments about the length of the marriage, let's first focus on what the district court found, and it didn't even get to that step.
Right. And I think what the court does make findings on her education, where she has a degree from the University of Khartoum. There was testimony, which we cite in our brief, that she was working part-time, and even though her employer testified there were full-time positions available, she had never applied for it.
Let's assume that's so. Simply saying that she can work full-time without taking into consideration what the income would be, what income would be generated working full-time, by comparison to husband's income, it seems to me the district court has essentially imputed, not just imputed income, but imputed income at a level sufficient to sustain the marital standard of living, which the district court doesn't precisely determine.
Well, and I think if you look at finding of fact 44, the court makes the finding that the budgets submitted by the parties don't establish the standard of living that exists during the parties' marriage, and that there was a lack of credibility with regard to that testimony. As a result, they did make a determination that she was capable of supporting herself without a dollar amount. And
so how do we know that? Without knowing how much income is imputed to her, and without knowing some baseline, even an estimate baseline, of what it would take for her to achieve the marital standard of living, how do we know? How can we affirm the district court's decision? How do we even analyze the district court's determination that she can meet her needs under the marital standard of living?
Well, without a dollar amount, you have to make an assumption. There's no doubt about that. It's not specific. But when the appellant in this case has the burden of presenting what their need is, or that they can't work, and as the court points out, has provided no documentation that she has attempted to find work or has even looked for work on a full-time basis, that is, it's significant. And added to that, she had been going to school for quite some time for her English language, which is what she claimed was the issue, that she couldn't find a job.
Well, I think we can, I don't want to read too much into the record, but I think we can assume that without an ability to fully master English, she could work at least in her current occupation full time, which I assume does not generate a substantial income by comparison to husband's income. And I mean, I guess I go back to my original question. Doesn't there need to be some understanding of what the imputation of income is, what the quantity of imputed income is in the analysis before determining that she can meet her needs under any marital standard?
I'm not aware of any case law that indicates they have to come up with a dollar amount of imputed income to her, other than she has the ability to meet her needs, which were relatively meager in terms of monthly expenses. I think the court also looked at, and this is the second part of the analysis, the ability to pay.
Before we get there, I mean, I think
does the court?
I think
before we get there, I'm wondering, in terms of what is necessary for someone seeking spousal maintenance under the first part, under that first subdivision, what do they have to prove? And there's two parts of that. One is you're looking at what property they have, including marital and non-marital property, and is that sufficient? But the other part is focused on what is the standard of living, what is the marital standard of living? So my question is, what do you think a person seeking spousal maintenance has to prove? And would it be sufficient for a district court to list, in this case, we have over $100,000 in debt, marital debt, and assets, marital assets that are, $13,000 or $14,000. And I'm putting aside the CRV for the moment. But if you have a marital standard of living that is measured by the estate, and the estate itself is $100,000 in debt, what does a person seeking spousal maintenance have to do to establish standard of living? Is it?
That's a great question. And the frank answer was no evidence was presented on any standard of living. The parties didn't go out. They didn't take vacations. They didn't buy extravagant items. None of that was presented in the record, and there was no evidence that that occurred. So, and most of these assets, incidentally, predated the marriage and certainly predated the cohabitation of parties, as did my client's income, which he was earning premaritally. And I think that's a significant issue. But I don't know if that answered your question, but.
I think Judge Bjorkman was going to jump in with one as well.
I think you answered. I mean, my trouble is that it seems to me the marital standard of living would be higher than $8,000. And so that's why I'm troubled. You know, we have findings with respect to at least the reasonable monthly expenses both parties submitted. I think everyone acknowledged that appellant was back in school and that maybe maintenance was not going to be a permanent thing, but to say no maintenance without any real assessment of the marital standard of living or any effort to impute some amount of income over $8,000 a year to appellant just troubles me. And, you know, I don't know what you can say to alleviate that concern and address the reviewability issue on that.
I apologize, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Let me address something that maybe is a little bit lost in the arguments here. It shouldn't be ignored that the respondent in this case paid spousal maintenance under an order for protection up to and after the first date of trial, which was more than a year and several months, which is longer than the time the parties were together during the marriage. I'm sure that was part of the consideration as well. So
going back to Judge Bryant's question, mm-hmm. or redirecting you as to the answer, you're talking about length of marriage, which is significant. And it perhaps once the district court reaches a decision on the first element, on the first step of the analysis, the court might look at it and say, yeah, maybe there's a need here, but the marriage was so brief, I'm not going to award spousal maintenance. And no one's disputing that's within the district court's discretion. But you seem to be continuing to work that into the analysis and the first steps, even though the district court didn't, and frankly, under the statute, wouldn't.
Yeah. And I don't have a great answer for that other than to point out the other facts that I'm sure were at play, which were there was evidence in the transcript and testimony that the appellant didn't forego any employment opportunities based on the marriage. She didn't work prior to their marriage. She lived with her parents. She didn't drive.
Again, you're going into factors that follow in the analysis at a stage that the district court didn't reach. Thank you. I think your time has expired, and we'll.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Brian has another question.
Judge Ross, if it's okay, I wanted to ask a kind of a brief question about what Mr. Bollier thinks was appealed.
But what was appealed was...
Just a minute. Let me be specific. I was asking Judge Ross for permission first, and then I was going to ask my question. Okay.
you have permission. So I
didn't mean to pause for an answer yet. The question is specific to the spousal maintenance decision. If you look at appellant's brief, the caption of the argument is about terminating the temporary spousal maintenance award that was tied to a different case matter in the OFP case that is not appealed. So do you believe that it is proper for us to consider the denial of the request to have ongoing spousal maintenance as part of the family case? Or do you believe that appellant has only appealed and mistakenly appealed the termination in a case number that's not actually before us?
Well, I do believe let me say that in two parts. First of all, that she did appeal a temporary order. I think that's clear cut, or the termination under a temporary order, which occurred prior to the completion of trial. However, that temporary spousal maintenance was also made part of the family court file in a later order. So I'm not going to argue that it's a different proceeding, because we had brought a motion in the family court file to terminate previously, which was addressed by the family court.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Boulier. Ms. Abul Hassan, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you very much. Going back to the accounts that counsel argued that they were his mother, again, if the district court allowed us to submit documents and bank statements, we would have been able to prove that all of the transactions were made by the respondent, and there was no single transaction made by his mother.
Mr. Abul Hassan, I started to interrupt. I know you don't have a lot of time, so I want to cut right to the chase on two aspects of these. Number one, the exhibits that were excluded, exhibit number 108 and then 110 through 117. Those are the exhibits that I think you're referring to in your brief. And my question for you is have those exhibits been submitted to this court?
I don't know, because the court receives the records from the district court, but I don't know if there is an exhibit that got it excluded that the court of appeals will have it. I have no idea.
We'll do our best to find it. And then the second question is those exhibit numbers that were excluded because of the valuation date and the judge's ruling on relevancy. It seemed like Mr. Boulier's argument is that those exhibit numbers relate exclusively to the three accounts that petitioner has power of attorney on. Do you agree that those are the accounts to which the exhibits that were excluded relate?
I believe all my exhibits that are excluded relate to proving if we had the chance that all of these accounts that the respondent claims are his mother's are not his mother's, because all the transactions are made by him and he commingled anyway, because for years he had his payroll directed to these accounts too, and he used the money again over and over. But we were not allowed to prove that. With regard,
Ms. Abul Hassan, if I could interrupt you just for a brief moment, just for a quick yes or no question before you jump back into your argument. Were you able during the break when Mr. Boulier was arguing to find in your brief a location, in your moving brief, your opening brief, an argument that the district court's finding of fact was clearly erroneous as it regards the characterization of the marital, of the debt as being marital?
I believe I did not find that, but I refer to it in a very brief way where I said, most of the debt the respondent has is premarital, and he testified on the record that last time he made a payment towards this debt was 20 years ago.
Okay.
That's my brief.
And one quick question, another question for you. I'll tell you some difficulty I'm having. I'm having difficulty on both sides with the imputation of income without specifying what that amount is. But the other problem I'm having is that the party seeking spousal maintenance is the party who has the burden to establish need based upon the marital standard of living and the income available. And the district court seems to have looked at this record and seen that the parties were way overextending themselves financially during the marriage, and was having a difficult time finding a real standard of living, because you can't base a standard of living on overspending. Whatever the party, however the parties were living, if they couldn't afford it, you can't burden one or the other parties, either party, to continue that standard of living or to pay the other spousal maintenance to meet that standard of living. So my difficulty here is in finding any error in the district court's determination that your client failed to establish any standard of living that would call into question the district court's concern that the parties were just living so far beyond their means that whatever that amount is, your client could meet her needs under that standard by working full time, even in a fast food restaurant. Can you address that?
Yes. The spousal maintenance amount covered almost 75% of my client's rent. Both parties were renters. I mean, when she lived with the respondent, he was renting. She's not going to live on the street. She mainly asked for spousal maintenance to be able to pay rent, because she has a co-signer and she didn't want to burden the co-signer. She was going to school to learn English. There was no testimony in court saying she could not get a job because she doesn't know English. She had a job on weekends as a cook, and she goes to school full time Monday through Friday. She doesn't drive. There was never a claim made that she cannot find a full time job or she didn't want to work full time. The only thing we kept focusing on was the testimony that she's a full-time student, you need to learn English to be sufficiently self-supporting. Next year, she will have to take the naturalization test where she needs to learn English.
Right, my question was going to the standard of living and whether your client provided evidence of the standard of living and whether your client established need based upon evidence of her income working full-time.
Both parties provided documentation and evidence showing how much they pay for rent. That's a standard of living. Both parties pay for food, clothes, utilities. That's standard of living. I'm having trouble with counsel's argument that there was no standard of living. That's a standard of living. As I stated,
I'm not talking about counsel's argument. I'm talking about the district court's finding. But we appreciate your argument today. Thank you for appearing. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your briefing. We apologize for the technological issues getting you both online, but we appreciate your participation both in your briefing and your oral argument today. The matter is submitted, taken under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. And this being the last case we have on our oral calendar for today, the court is in recess. Thanks to you all.